The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. A sunny day here in Southern California, and we are one day removed from a really special documentary that we ran last night called Unguarded, which was a story by Jonathan Hawk about a basketball player named Chris Herron, and it really resonated with the audience, so much so that we have decided to add a second airing that will be tonight, Wednesday night, 8 o'clock, ESPN2, and also it's going to run again on Saturday morning at 7 a.m. on ESPN2. It's worth watching, and I hope, if you didn't see it last night, I hope you get a chance to watch it. On the Subway Fresh Tech Hotline right now, the star of that documentary, Chris Herron. What's happening?
How are you?
What was your, tell me what your last 12 hours was like after that documentary aired.
It was intense. It really was. It was, extremely, humbling, emotional for me. You know, the emails, that I've received in the last 10 hours have ranged from, you know, I've been married 10 years and I've kept a secret with addiction. I just told my wife after watching and I'm going into treatment. You know, to, you know, children who are, children whose parents are in the midst of it, and they're just reaching out as a sounding board to me.
Yeah.
So it's been amazing. I mean, it really has.
When was the first time you saw a finished cut of that documentary?
Probably about a week and a half ago. Jonathan sent it to me through email, and my son and I went down in the basement of my home and sat on a couch and watched it together, which was extremely emotional. But once I know I could get through that, then I was prepared to deal with whatever came out of it, you know.
Did your son know most of that stuff, or was he learning the stuff as it was going on?
He knew. Little Chris was 9 when I got sober and had lived through a lot of it. You know, I believe the last three years and 3 months, he's, you know, the memories, the bad memories are much further back. But he actually handled it much, much better than I thought. You know, I thought it was going to be, I was actually dreading doing it, and very anxious about it. But he was great. I mean, he responded very well. He cried, smiled, laughed, and then at the end said, you know, that he's proud. And, that made it all worth it.
Yeah. What was the toughest single part of that documentary for you to watch?
You know, I would say my younger years, meaning BC, Durfee, you know, Fresno.
Yeah.
Because the last 9 years and what I went through, I've treated, you know, therapeutically, you know, I've gone through that process. I hadn't really touched into my younger years. So watching that brought a lot of emotion out of me.
You talk about the clips of you playing when you're at your
peak? Just the clips, my mom talking, my dad talking, you know, the press conference at Fresno State, you know, watching Coach Tarkanian cry.
Right.
You know, all of that. It just kicked up emotions in me that I really hadn't dealt with for a long time. So when I first viewed it, it was difficult.
Did you cry when you were watching it?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
I could cry last night, you know. I mean, I cried last night.
Yeah. Well, that must have been something to see that finally be on ESPN, you know, obviously the biggest sports network. I think it got a pretty good rating. I mean, I know from just my experience of just emails and tweets and stuff like that, it seemed like people joined you know, people who didn't start watching it were flicking channels and just stumbled into it and just stuck with it. Could you feel as the doc was going, was like your BlackBerry blowing up and stuff?
Yeah, you did. You blew it up. I haven't been able to pick up my iPhone since.
Oh, because of Twitter.
Yeah, it's just notifications just keep coming through. You know, it was great. I mean, you know, it's a lot of heart and soul was put into that, you know, from a lot of people. And you know, my wife, you know, having the cameras around with my children, you know, Jonathan, G-Lock, Alex, you know, the whole crew, you know, poured a lot of their time and energy into it. So to see it and see the effect that it had, and is still having, I think that makes it all well worth it.
What made you ultimately decide to let somebody fly around with cameras?
You know, I believe wholeheartedly that, you know, the easy road for me would to never look back. You know, here I am sober, forget me when I was high. This is who I am today, and keep moving forward. But I believe that that's a disservice to addicts still struggling.
Yeah.
I believe it's a disservice to kids who, you know, are thinking about getting into it. And I had a opportunity, because of, you know, my past, whether it's basketball, or other documentaries to put this together with Jonathan. And I thought that it would be a great message, you know, although tough, a great message to put out there.
Yeah. It was, you know, really interesting for me to watch because, you know, I was living in Boston when you were coming up and, you know, there really was a legend of Chris Herron. You were playing in Fall River, which was pretty far from Boston, but still everybody knew who you were. Everybody knew there was a 6 foot, what were you, 6 foot four, 6 foot five?
No, even shorter. I'm 6'2" if I'm lucky.
Man, that alley-oop, I was thinking you were taller than I was. That alley-oop from high school, holy mackerel. You got up back then.
I was blessed with some athletic ability. I was dunking
apparently
in the eighth grade, and you know, I started dunking the ball when I was like 5'9", 5'10", and you know, I'm 6'2" on a good day.
Ah, well, you sound like me. But there was this legend about you, and you know, I think a little bit of that had to do with the fact that you were white, and you were. This was also an era in Massachusetts basketball when the AAU stuff was starting. And it was just year after year, there would almost be this class of players. And I remember when I was writing for the Boston Herald, I was covering high school sports, and like my class was, the first class I covered was like Elton Tyler, Monty Mack, people like that. But you were a little bit before that. And in my opinion, you were the biggest high school basketball player of that era. I mean, you were not only were you McDonald's All-American, but you were probably on that short list of the best five or six or seven guys from that class, right?
Sure, sure.
Who were the other guys?
That class, you know, honestly, the class was pretty weak. You know, Iverson had dropped out of it, but in that McDonald's All-American class, he dropped out of it because when he went to jail. But Antoine Walker, Lorenzen Wright, Adonel Foyle, Felipe Lopez.
Right.
Honestly, I'm not sure if there was a West Coast kid to make the NBA from that class. I think there was a total of maybe five guys who made the NBA.
Yeah. And that was, you were traveling around, what, like 60, 70 games in the summer?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we had a great team. I mean, you know, you think about it, Scoonie Penn, Wayne Turner, Eddie McCray, myself, that's a pretty good, you know, some pretty good gods with the Curley brothers and Randall Jackson who played at Florida State. So,
yeah,
those were great times.
Yeah. You went to BC. What were your other options at that point?
Oh, Kentucky, Florida, Wisconsin, Syracuse. Those are the schools that I visited. You know, Wisconsin was Stu Jackson and Van Gundy at that time. That's why my interest was there. But, you know, Jim O'Brien, who recruited my older brother, who recruited Michael. I had a relationship with, and you know, BC, you know, was the one for me at that time.
Because I mean, that's a Massachusetts thing. People like staying close to home, and in retrospect, probably the worst thing you could have done. Do you feel like you would have gotten into the same trouble that you eventually got into if you were at Duke or Kentucky?
I do.
Yeah.
Maybe not immediate. I believe it would have happened eventually.
Yeah.
You know, if I could do it differently, I probably would have went to prep school for a year and sat in a boarding, you know, in a prep school type environment where a little more freedom on your own and try to get acclimated to something like that. But I believe any campus that I walked on, I was making bad decisions in high school. You know, I was drinking too much. I was smoking too much. And, you know, that was my lifestyle. And I believe I would have ran into that anywhere. And unfortunately, you know, BC, and I really don't enjoy saying it, you know, that was the first time at Boston College. And I feel bad in a sense.
Yeah.
Because I don't want, you know, like BC to come off as this campus where, you know, it was filled with it. You know what I mean? And I feel guilty at times. But it had nothing to do with them. It was, you know, everything to do with me.
Right. And let's be honest. I mean, I went to college from 88 to 92. Cocaine was at every campus. Like, if you were going to find it, or if you wanted to find it, you were going to find it.
Sure.
It didn't really matter what school it was. You took a ton of heat when you failed the drug test at BC and you had to leave. And, you know, the way people were writing about it, it was like, oh, man, what a screw up. And,
you know,
and nobody really gave you the benefit of the doubt. Like, man, maybe this kid has a real problem. Like, the attitude of the people that wrote about it at the time and the people that talked about it on the radio was, this kid's a bad kid. He hangs out with bad people. He's doing bad things. Like, could you sense that as that was happening?
Well, Will McDonough, he's the one that broke it.
Right.
You know, because I tried in my own little deceitful way to hide it. And because what the penalty was that I was going to have to sit out another year.
Yeah.
And well, I figured, well, the way I can hide this mess is to transfer. So when I decided to transfer, it was leaked out and Will McDonough caught it and said, you know, he put that big article out there and basically outed me.
Yeah.
It's tough for an 18-year-old kid to be, you know, to listen to people talk about them in that type of light. You know, it's never easy. My parents were getting divorced. My dad was just getting out of politics. Like my brother said in the film, it was ugly at home. So to add that to that, it was very difficult.
Yeah. And you also came from, you know, there's these cities and towns in Massachusetts that definitely have that us against everyone else kind of feel to them. And I feel like Fall River is one of those. Like, you're from Fall River. It's you guys against the world. And I'm sure that kind of tied into that, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you kind of, and I tried to express it in the film, and I don't know if it came off as well as I feel it in my heart. But, you know, Fall River, you know, again, is like the BC. It tends to get, you know, the blame for a lot, you know.
Right.
You know, like, oh, man, you got to stay out of Fall River. Or, Chris, man, don't go back to Boston. Or, you know, guess what? You know, I just got done playing in 7 different countries, Fall River, thousands and thousands of miles away, and I'm holed up in my hotel room in Tehran, Iran. It has nothing to do with it. You know, like, once I figured out that, you know, it was me, you know, and it had nothing to do with the friends I was with. It had nothing to do with the city I grew up in. It was more of a problem that I had to deal with. And once I dealt with it, you know, I'm in Fall River. I told a guy today, you know, I'm in Fall River quite a bit now. You know, I'm not getting high. So Fall River is a special place, and it definitely has that sense of me against, you know, us against the rest. But it's a tough city. It's a blue collar city, and I think that's where it comes from.
How much did the book came out in September 1995, and it was after you had left BC, and
yep.
You know, it was basically like a Friday Night Lights type book about your high school and Bill Reynolds, who you became close to, had been working on it for a couple of years, and at that point, you were the guy, you know, the troubled kid who had left BC, and now you're like being immortalized in this book. Did that help or hurt things?
The book hurt.
Yeah.
That attention, I was never comfortable with.
Yeah.
You know, I never read the book, because of my relationship with Reynolds. I don't believe, and I think it was a great judgment call on my part at that age, because I think that I probably would have pushed him away if I read it.
Yeah.
And, you know, people would come up to me and say, oh, man, I can't believe you said this in high school. I can't believe you said that in high school. And, you know, it just brought a lot of attention that I wasn't ready for and I wasn't comfortable with.
Yeah.
You know, you say a lot of dumb things, you know, when a guy's got a pen and a paper for 2 years straight at, you know, 16 years old.
Right.
So with me coming out of BC and basically humiliated myself, you know, for the short stint that I was there, when that pops out, it's like, oh, man, like, here's a kid who's, you know, will never live up to his hype, you know?
Yeah. Well, and also, what's the age difference between you and your brother?
5 years.
So your brother, as was pointed out in the film, and I don't know if people caught that, but there was a Boston Garden clip in there, which was like, you know, the pinnacle of anyone who played high school basketball in Massachusetts. You wanted to get to the Garden and you wanted to win a game there. You were the younger brother. As this often happens in sports, the younger brother is always a little bit better than the older brother because he was playing with the older brother trying to catch up to him. So from like, what, sixth grade on, you must have been getting attention as, oh, you think this kid's good. Wait till you see his little brother. That was happening, right?
Of course. I mean, my games as a kid would be packed.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember as a young kid walking into gymnasiums and taking heat from other parents in youth leagues. And, you know, like my stomach just wrenched, you know, like it was in knots. Walking into a gymnasium, and we're talking seventh grade, sixth grade, you know, because of the hype that my brother of winning state championships and not losing, only losing one game. And, you know, there was a lot of attention back then. Back then, you know, as you know, there was no internet, you know, so Durfee basketball was like the Celtics around here. You know, the Fall River papers didn't cover regional schools. They only covered Durfee. So, you know, it was huge. I mean, season ticket holders at high school. You know, I mean, that's pretty intense.
And there was also like from the part of Massachusetts where you were from, and like the part where the closer to Boston and people like that, there was a nice little rivalry between those two regions.
Of course.
And that played into that too. And you know, I think that the local schools got a little more attention just because it was easier to go to the games. It was harder to drive out to Fall River, things like that. But it certainly seemed like, you know, at your peak there, you were packing the gyms everywhere, and people seemed to think like, oh, this kid's definitely going on to great things and all that stuff. Did you just assume you were going to play in the NBA for 15 years?
Never assumed I would even play in the NBA.
Really?
Honest to God. You know, I mean, it was never on my radar, you know, and that's how kind of my basketball career went. And, you know, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I never looked to the future really for basketball. I was just always worried about the next game. Like, let me deal with this next game because there's a lot riding on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was probably the wrong way, wrong approach, maybe, because, you know, there was a lot of built-up competitiveness day in and day out. But I never thought I would be a McDonald's All-American. And then, you know, I came on the scene in the AAU, and boom, here I am.
Yeah.
From there, you know, I went to BC and got taught, and I was gone. Fresno, I sat out a year, and, you know, I just figured, you know, I'm gonna be a good, you know, I'm gonna be a college basketball player. My first game at Fresno, I got my butt kicked. You know, I played
really
played at Oregon in their old gym, and they put this 6'6" wingman on me who was athletic and just locked me up. And I questioned myself. And my next game was that UMass game, And then after coming off of that game, you know, I said, you know, maybe I got a chance, but then my lifestyle would always bring me back. You know, my lifestyle, I would always say, like, how am I going to be an NBA player, man, when I'm out, you know, for three straight days?
Right.
You know.
Your brother had an interesting, or your mother had an interesting quote about your brother in the documentary that I thought was a tough one to hear, just that saying that your brother, the greatest moment of his life was winning that high school title, and that's what all he wanted. And he was 18, and he had accomplished his dream, and where do you go from there? Did you feel like that was a little bit the case with you, too, or no?
No, because I knew that type of dream wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I saw what it did to Michael, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, his basketball kind of stopped once he reached those levels. And I think that's what my mom was getting to.
Yeah.
You know, Durfee basketball, you went to Disney World if you won. You know, Coach Karam got a brand new Lincoln. You know, you were showered with gifts. I mean, it was like winning the Super Bowl. And, you know, Michael, when he did that 2 years in a row, it was kind of, you know, he was kind of all set, you know. And not to mention he sacrificed himself being 6'4", playing down low, you know, and then goes into the Big East where 6'4" guys play point guard.
Right.
You know, and, you know, you're not the most athletic, the fastest, and now here you are 6'4", and you've been playing a small forward your whole life. That's tough to match.
Right. Watching the film, you know, it's pretty amazing that you were able to play, you know, be out three straight nights and just abuse your body in all kinds of ways. And then you're going out into these college games and you're dominating some of them. Like, walk me through how that was able to happen.
You know, it was hard. You know, I think the only thing that got me through those nights, was the fear of embarrassment and shame and you know, getting my butt kicked.
Yeah.
It was just going off pure adrenaline. And, you know, obviously UMass coming back to Fresno, I knew that they were going to come for some blood. And I remember it was probably 3 o'clock in the morning and me saying to myself, gosh, do I go to sleep now or do I just stay out for the rest of it? And pulling into that arena, and I was just like, oh, man, you know, this is going to be a tough night. And I got, in a sense, you know, I mean, I got lucky.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I could have went out there and who knows? My heart exploded. I had a heart attack. You know, that night, I got through that night. That's tough to watch, knowing where I, you know, that I was, where I was 4 hours earlier.
I got to ask, you were a big Celtic fan growing up, right?
Of course.
So Len Bias dies of a cocaine overdose in 1986, kills a potential dynasty. I know that's why, this sounds stupid, but I've never tried cocaine, and that just put the fear of God in me for life. Was that ever in the back of your mind, like the Len Bias thing?
Absolutely. And when I go around and I speak, that's exactly what I explain to everybody who Len Bias is and who he was to me. And when I was at that pivotal moment, his face flashed before me. You know,
really?
I mean, I associated cocaine with Len Bias.
Me too.
But the people in the room that night saying, it's not a big deal. Look, I mean, we've been doing it for the last 2 hours. It's not, you know, it's not going to kill you. You know, that tug pulled me right into it. And, you know, here I am, in the Big East, Sports Illustrated, all these honors, but my self-esteem wasn't high enough to say no, you know, which is, you know, very telling, that I couldn't walk away from it.
Well, part of addiction is almost like it's self-sabotage.
Sure.
Do you feel like that was going on there a little bit, like too much good stuff was happening for you and you just almost wanted to sabotage it?
That happened quite a bit. You know, I mean, there were times at Fresno. My sophomore year, I was in great shape. And Coach Welch, who's now an assistant with the Nuggets, was my guy, and he was sober. And him and I went to the gym, and I worked my tail off that red shirt year into my sophomore year. And you can, you know, for me, I can watch it on video and see my sophomore year and how I looked physically. it's amazing compared to how I look 2 years later in my senior year. And I look like a basketball player. And, you know, but once I, you know, that redshirt year was great because it was quiet. There was no media. There was no attention. I adjusted really well to that. And then once that sophomore year came and some notoriety started coming with it, you know, and you know, I associated notoriety with nightclubs. You know, like that's a good feeling. People are noticing me. Well, let me really go get noticed. And I chased that, and that was part of it.
And probably moving some of the Fall River guys out there might not have been the greatest idea.
Wasn't the best idea.
Yeah, I don't think sadly. Having an entourage maybe wasn't going to help.
No, absolutely not. I mean, we were talking about it the other day, and the guy in that documentary, Kevin, who he always takes a beating because he was the first one to move out, and him and I were childhood friends. You know, he's the one that got me sober. He has, you know, we grew up together since we were 5 years old, and Kevin has 9 years. He got sober after I left Fresno, and, you know, it was ugly. I mean, I was living in a two-bedroom apartment with nine guys from Fall River.
Nine?
Yeah, there would be nine. You know, wow. I mean, at all times, five. But, you know, we would have visitors constantly.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, and I think in the documentary, the point was made, I think, by your brother. And it's a great point, and it's something we see in sports all the time, is when you're getting a lot of attention or whoever, and, you know, there comes a point where you're not really sure who to trust. You don't know if somebody likes you just because you're the famous basketball player or not because of who you are as a person.
Sure.
And what happens is you gravitate toward the people who knew you when you were nobody.
Yeah.
And you gravitated to all those people. And, you know, unfortunately, all those people liked to party. And it did seem like that was part of what was going on with you.
And as did I. And it was, you know, so that made it a terrible, terrible mix. You know, and, you know, like my brother said that, you know, I didn't know when to say when. I had a tough time with that, and he's right on the money. You know, I would be in a room full of 20 people at a party, and once it hit 2 o'clock in the morning and people started going home, I was just, like, waking up, you know, and my addiction was, like, just firing up and kicking in, and I'm like, you know, I'm gone. I'm out.
At what point did you cross the line from guy who loves to party? Because I'll be honest, I had a few big nights in my day, and I knew a lot of people in college who were out five nights a week and stuff like that. At what point does that cross the line to, I need to go out? My body is telling me that I need to go out and do this. Do you remember, like, what year that was when that changed for you?
Sure. I never, ever got that with cocaine. My body never told me I need it. The thing with cocaine was once I had a couple of beers in me, you know, when I was at a club or a bar, and once I got a couple of beers in me and I started feeling that feeling, then it kicked in, let's go get coke. And that was every time. Now, opiates were a whole nother monster. You know, like that's an animal, a gorilla that, you know, that grabs you by the throat and says, whether you like it or not, you're getting it this morning.
Right.
You know.
And that didn't happen to you until you were in the pros.
Yes, and that happened the summer between getting traded to the Celtics. When I came home from the Nuggets, that's when I jumped on with OxyContin.
Oof. How good were you? Because I was watching those clips, and, you know, there's a couple of things that stood out, and I remember watching you, you know, in college at the time and stuff, and just following your career. And, you know, you had 25-foot range, so you easily – let's say you're sober and you're just in the NBA and, you know, you didn't abuse your body and it's just the best that you could have done. I feel like you could have played for like 12 to 13 years as like that Steve Kerr spot up shooter guy, but you were also athletic too. I feel like you would have had a good career. Like, am I overrating that?
I don't know. I think that's very accurate. I mean, you know, I was able to accomplish, the highest level that you can get to, you know, with a lot of mistakes along the way. You know, and not only, I mean, let's be real, I'm 6'1" and a white kid, you know, how many of them make it, you know?
But you're super athletic though. I mean, you were much more athletic than the typical 6'1" white guy.
No, absolutely. And that's what kept me in the game. And that's what allowed me to continue. If I was a, you know, if I wasn't athletic, then I wouldn't have been in it long. But it's, you know, my career could have, I could have had a long one, I would assume. You know, but the reality is, you know, and I know at times it's like, really, Chris, because, you know, it's the silver lining in this, and I wholeheartedly believe this 100%. You know, my career was cut short because of my addiction issues. But, you know, when I walk into a college or a high school, them kids get on the edge of their seat because of the resume. You know, because, oh, wait a second, you know, let's listen to this guy. He played for the Celtics. And that's the beauty of it, you know, and that's why this documentary is special, you know, because, and I think that's why, you know, I'll bear my soul and tell you what I lost and the opportunities that I had, as a result from drugs and alcohol. But I'm also going to tell you at the end that there's a way out, you know?
Yeah. I went to some of those Celtic games, by the way.
Yeah.
I was, I remember you had, I think it was your first home start. I don't remember who you were playing, but you had a really good game.
Sure.
And it was like mid-November. It was like whatever the first home game was. People were fired up, local kids, Celtics.
Yeah.
It was a great story. You were clean. We didn't know you weren't clean, but we thought
you
were. And I remember thinking, defensively a little weak.
Yeah.
I think they could exploit him, but, 25-foot range, runs the team. And this guy's gonna help us. And then within, I don't know, like 2-3 months, you got released. And as you point out in the documentary, like you were leading this whole secret life and trying to get oxy. And it's kind of amazing that you were even playing when you look back, right?
Sure. Well, no. See, the year I was released in my second year, I ended up making it through the first year because of an injury. Coach Pitino was great and gave me chances to play. And I remember that game, you know, winning that game, walking off with the ball in my hand and the pitcher in the paper. But, you know, then the, you know, Coach Pitino left and O'Brien took over. And I came back for like the last 15 games, 10 games. And then I came back the following year and they released me. But slow defensively, I mean, I don't say this with any sense of, you know, pride that, you know, I had probably, you know, 1600 milligrams of OxyContin in my body, which is mental, you know?
Well, and also, I mean, you could see it in the documentary, like the way your body looked as a sophomore in college.
Sure.
Versus the way it looked 4 years later. I mean, it was clear that you had done a lot. And it had just kind of fundamentally changed what you looked like and what your speed was. And
even my appearance.
Lose a half a step. Yeah.
Yeah. But even my appearance. I mean, one writer said, like, dude, you don't even look like the same person anymore. You know, today as opposed to, you know, 10 years ago, whatever it was with the Celtics. You know? You know, here you are a professional athlete now and you look like, you know, you look like your body's like, you know, like you haven't played basketball in 10 years.
Right.
You know,
the other interesting thing about that documentary, well, there's a lot of interesting things, but, I never realized that you and Tarkanian were that close. I mean, he gets choked up 3 times just in the film. And, what was it about you and him that just clicked like that? He called you his favorite player other than his son that he ever coached.
Sure. I think that I was his first big, you know, recruit there.
Yeah.
You know, he called me. I was at a buddy's house. He called me. He said, you know, I'm starting over. I want you to be with me. And I said, I'm with you. And I jumped on a plane. And I think he never forgot that. I also think that he knew, you know, I was obviously, you know, like he said, breaking hearts. But ultimately, I was breaking my own heart. You know, I mean, when it's all said and done with, you're hurting yourself the most. And he, you know, I think he saw that I wanted to be good. You know, I wanted to do right. I think he saw who I was as a person, but just had this thing that he couldn't really relate to. I think his generation, you know, drugs were not very prevalent in his generation.
Yeah.
You know, pharmaceuticals and cocaine, that wasn't his generation. So it was, like, baffling to him that I could be involved in this. You know, so, but our relationship, you know, and I hope, you know, I think there's people out there who can, you know, watch the film and take different and have different opinions and views on Tark. But one thing I wanted to get across is how good of a man he is. And and put basketball aside, he cares about the human, you know, aspect of it.
At what point did you realize that you just, you know, you were still playing professionally, but you had just done too much damage to yourself and it was never going to really happen?
You know, once I left the Celtics, it was all downhill. You know, I mean, and I try to tell that to kids. You know, I went from the Celtics to the EuroLeague, to B level in Istanbul, to China 2 years in a row, to Warsaw, to Tehran. I mean, look at the decline in location, salary. And I was basically just playing basketball I was robbing Peter to pay Paul. You know, like, I was playing basketball to try to keep my family's bills up and my drug addiction fed. And that was the only reason.
Yeah. I forgot to ask you this. So you mentioned, kind of skimped over in the documentary just because you don't have a ton of time, but in Denver, your rookie year, you said Van Exel and McDice took you aside and told you they were looking out for you. The team wasn't going to go out. I was kind of fascinated by that. They really stuck with that for 6 months? They did that for you?
They were unbelievable to me. I mean, I can't tell you. I was on the phone with George McLeod today. And, you know, George was really the ringleader of it. And his, for some reason, when I spoke that day, I didn't say his name. But he was really the ringleader. And, you know, he was like, listen, I've seen enough in my life. And, you know, I know one thing, that when you're on my watch, you're not blowing this opportunity. And I remember we were telling a story and we were laughing about it today. There's this strip club in Miami and they decided that they would bring me that night. George is from Miami. And sure enough, Chris is, you know, I fired up, you know, my addiction, and George found me at 5 o'clock in the morning somewhere else and was like, I felt like it was like my dad found me, you know, and he grabbed me right by the back of my neck and told me to get up, get out, and we're going back to the hotel. But those guys were unbelievable. Antonio McDice, I was surrounded by Popeye Jones, great guy. Brian Stith was a great guy.
Really good guy.
Yeah. Roy Rogers, great guy. Antonio, as good as you can get. You know, George was like the big brother in that group.
Ray LaFrance, right? Wasn't he on that team?
Ray LaFrance, great guy. Chauncey Billups. It was just team. It was just a team of good people. You know, it really was. And not big into the social scene, but they looked out for my best interest. You know.
So you slipped up a couple times that year, but for the most part, you were pretty clean.
Sure.
So maybe that trade doesn't happen. Maybe it just prolongs what would have happened anyway, but maybe you get a couple more NBA years out of that. Is that fair?
I would think, yeah. I think it would, you know, I'd like, you know, I always say that I think it would have just prolonged it, but I probably would have, you know, lasted and stuck a little while longer because of that. Dan Issel was amazing, you know, like... Yeah. You know, and I had the honor to get his number 6 months ago and call him out of the blue and just say, hey, this is Chris Herron. I don't know if you know or remember me, but thank you. And he was great to me. You know, I mean, he took a chance, and I apologize for not taking advantage of it to him, but also thanked him for giving me an opportunity. And that environment for me was a great fit.
Yeah. I got to ask one dorky basketball question.
Sure.
when you were on the Celtics that first year, that was when Pitino really totally had lost control of the team.
Yes.
And, I mean, it was just crazy to go to those games. I don't think I've ever seen players that seem to resent or dislike their coach like that.
Sure.
What was that like to play on a team like that?
It was tough. I personally didn't condone it because of, I'm a loyal guy,
yeah.
You know, and Antoine Walker was paid millions of dollars because of him.
Yeah, you know, $71 million, that new contract extension.
Ron Mercer, Walter McCarty, you know, all these guys. You know, he made Eric Williams, you know, all these guys millions and millions of dollars. And then they treat him like that. To me, that's not my style. You know,
yeah.
It was a mutiny, is what it was. And, you know, I didn't like it, but, you know, I had my own little personal mutiny going on anyway, you know.
So, right.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it in that way. I had my own little, you know, personal mutiny going on.
Right.
But, you know, it was hard. I watched how hard he worked, you know. Although it didn't work out for him, it wasn't because of lack of effort.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he worked at being, you know, a good coach, and to see how much time and effort he put into it and what he sacrificed for it to blow up in his face was disappointing.
I think the biggest problem was he had been marketed as a savior of the Celtics, and he was making a ton of money, and he was the face of the franchise. And I think at that specific time in the NBA, I don't think the players wanted that. I don't think you wanted a coach who was a celebrity. You wanted a coach who was just going to, you know, listen to what you wanted to do, and it was just a bad fit all around. You got to know Paul Pierce, I'm sure, a little bit.
Yep.
He's now, you know, I would say one of the best 50 basketball players of all time. He's certainly
sure.
turned his life around. You knew him when he was a little more immature.
Yep.
Were you surprised that he was able to get to the point that he's at now?
No. And I'll tell you why. Because Paul Pierce, every day that I went to the gym, Paul Pierce was already soaking wet.
Really?
Yeah. Every single day. Yeah. Every day that I showed up to practice, Paul Pierce was there. Already drenched and ready for round two. And, you know, I say that all the time. You know, when we would have long road trips and veterans would say, I'm not going to practice today. And Antoine would kind of sit on the sidelines. Paul didn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, Paul grinded it out and was one of 12, you know. And I saw that in him. He was very, very focused and passionate about being good at that young age, you know, and so for me it was not surprising.
Also, probably not surprising for you to find out that Antoine spent all his money. You were there playing with him, and he was a pretty extravagant guy even back then, right?
Tragic, you know, and
yeah.
You know, for all of Antoine's shortcomings and you know, the tough love he gets, you know, I pray for him because, you know, to recover from spending $120 million in your lifetime, you know,
yeah.
by the age of 35 is very, very tough to overcome, I would assume.
Could you see that stuff happening even in 2000, just the way
sure,
he was
sure, because he was pulling up in convertible Bentleys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, that's like Rockefeller money.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's like generations of money. Not a guy who's, you know, gonna make it for 10 years.
Yeah.
You also
had Kenny Anderson on that team, who
yeah.
was having similar struggles, not spending his money. He was spending a lot of it, and also he's talked about it now. He had a drinking problem when he played. Did you know
sure.
that he had a problem when you were playing with him?
Yeah. And see, the thing with me with the Celtics, I just was never into, and I don't believe it was a team. You know,
yeah.
it was not a unit. You know, you would see Paul and, you know, the kid from
Tony
Colorado
Bitté.
State,
yeah.
the point guard.
Tony Bitté. Oh, Billups, yeah.
Yeah. What's his name? I played against him in the WAC. He was like a backup point guard. Milt Palacio.
Yeah, yeah.
Milton Palacio, Paul, Tony Battee, they would go their way. You know, and Antoine, you know, Walter, a couple would go their way, and then Kenny would have his group. You know, and Kenny, you know, I almost felt bad for now. You know, I mean, nobody knew my story yet. So,
yeah.
You know, I could look at him and say, sheepish, you know, he seemed like he was a hurting soul, you know, at that point in his life. And you know, although I didn't know what was going on because I didn't do it, I was sending, you know, I was sending packages around the country, FedEx, filled with OxyContin to make sure I had it on the next, you know, on the next home, road game. Ugh. So I was focused on other things rather than the team aspect of it.
Yeah. And you and Kenny, it's a little bit similar because, like you, he got a ton of attention from a really early point in his life, all the way through, became like the savior of sorts. Never really fully realized his potential. I guess the difference is he made probably $90 million along the way, made an all-star team and all that stuff. But, you know, still I look at him and I feel like that's somebody that should have had one of the most memorable careers of that generation. He didn't.
Sure. And the difference between me and Kenny, like you said, the $90 million, and I thank God that I didn't have $90 million, you know, because
you would have spent it.
I wouldn't have been here, you know. Yeah. I'd be dead if I had that type of money. And you know, I spoke to Kenny on the phone about 6-7 months ago, and we had a nice talk. And you know, it's humbling. You know, if I can say one thing to kids today that I'm with. You know, that, listen, I don't care how good you are, basketball will be done at 35. I mean, if you're the best in the world, you're done at 35. You know, your days are over, in a sense. And, you know, you have two-thirds of your life left to live. And that's what Kenny's figuring out now. Like, you know, what can I do to function, you know, as a citizen, as a regular person, not as, you know, who I was built up to be and who I used to be.
So when you know, knowing that and what you just said and everything, when you see that these players right now, and I'm not asking you to defend the owner's position or anything, just the fact that we're not playing basketball right now, and you know how short of a shelf life an NBA career is, do you think this is crazy?
Of course. I mean, there's a very short window to make this money. What's the average career of an NBA basketball player? I mean, I remember when I was there, I think it was like 2.9 years,
yeah,
you know, or 3 years. That was the average. Now, obviously, there's guys that go on longer, but what about these rookies who, you know, are sitting out a whole year? You know, in a sense, from March Madness or from that time last year.
Yeah.
You know, and they're going to miss that opportunity. The second round picks who were going to get overlooked. You know, that they were going to have a chance to grab onto a roster spot and maybe get a 2-year contract. But, you know, the next batch will be coming in.
Are you still watching a lot of basketball? Like, do you consider yourself a diehard fan, or is it just tough for you knowing?
I don't consider myself a diehard fan. You know, I'm a diehard Celtics fan. You know, I'll watch the Celtics. I'm a local, you know, fan. And now with Hoop Dreams, I'm a fan of the kids' schools that, you know, they play for.
Yep.
So I track them, keep track of their numbers and their stats. But I stay, you know, green with the Celtics.
All right, good. That's nice to hear. You've been sober 3 years now? What's the exact date that you were sober?
August 1st, 2008. So 3 years and 3 months.
Wow.
Amazing.
Obviously, you hear this all the time, take it day by day by day by day.
Sure.
What made you start speaking in front of big crowds? Like you're really good at it. And I wonder, like, what was the first time you did that? And when did you realize, I'm good at this, I should keep doing it?
You know, I think Franklin Pierce, a college up in New Hampshire, the AD called me and said, hey, you know, you're a year sober, but I want my kids to hear the message. You know, I went up there and I spoke, and I was probably terrible at it. You know, I was scared. I was nervous. My arms were crossed the whole time. And, you know, just as I got more comfortable in my own skin through sobriety, I believe I got better at it, you know, and obviously with practice. And, you know, I grew up, my dad was a politician, you know, my mom was a smart woman. You know, I've been in a lot of social circles, you know, other than parties and that type of lifestyle. And my training as a kid with media, you know, from, you know, starting as a freshman with John Dennis, you know, and Bob Lobel, the high five, you know, I mean, I was 13, 14 years old doing the high five. And, you know, so I think that, you know, all of that, has helped me prepare for this. And I'm passionate about it, you know, and I think if you're passionate about it, I think that comes across.
How many of them are you doing a year now?
Oh boy, I got about 50 of them just in the last 10 hours, you know, that came in. Now I haven't really had the program, American Program Bureau, the people that represent me for this, you know, they'll go through it and see, you know, who can, you know, which place I will go to. But this year, I say probably about 3 a month.
Well, I know you're not doing it for money, but, I mean, this is potentially a full-time job and something that will make money for you because, again, you're good at it. And, you know, you could, every time you do this, not only affect people's lives but get paid to do so. Like, that's a pretty good life.
Sure. And you know, I've been fortunate. In the last year, I started making money.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, a big change for me and my family. It was great for us. And, you know, but I'm terrible at it. So if people get to me first, you know, and say, well, we really don't have a budget. I'm like, well, perfect. I don't care. I'll do it. You know, I'm a terrible businessman. I really am. If you tell me you don't have a budget and it's for a good cause, I'm there. And, you know, which kind of drives the people crazy that are supposed to do this for me, but that's who I am. And, you know, I'll do it for anybody. And, you know, you can make a living out of it. And in the last 10 hours, you know, 40, 50 people have inquired about me coming to different places all over the country.
What's the most powerful memory that you have from doing one of those? Is there one story that jumps out?
Sure. I was speaking, it was actually on the film, Dartmouth High School. That was the opening scene. And I always open it up to question and answers at the end. And the kids had been in the auditorium for a while. And this little girl raised her hand, and she was a little overweight. And the kids around her basically, like, shushed her to put her hand down. So I saw that happen, and I walked over to her section, and I asked her, go ahead, don't worry about them, ask your question. She was so intimidated by her peers around her that she didn't ask. A week goes by, 2 weeks go by, I get an email from that girl saying, I was the girl that didn't ask the question, but my question was about bullying. And I said, you know, and I read it through her email. What her email wrote, what she wrote to me was that she said, Mr. Heron, I want to thank you. The courage that you showed that day, speaking about all the bad things that happened in your life, gave me some courage. And the reason I needed courage is because I had a group of six girls that have been picking on me since eighth grade, and I'm a junior in high school. I'm overweight. My parents are divorced. I don't have a lot of money, and I dress, you know, I don't have much of a wardrobe. And she said, these girls pick on me and goof on me, and every day I go home and I cut myself. I sit in my room on my bed, and I, with a razor blade, I slice my arm. And she said, because of you coming to my school, telling this story, and having that type of courage, it gave me the courage to confront them a week later in the cafeteria. And I walked over to them, and I rolled up my sleeves, and I showed them the scars. And she said, they've never picked on me since. And thank you. And, like, for me, that's like, I'll die with that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
It really
is.
I mean,
so you figure you do these things and you're going to resonate with at least one person in that room, right?
Sure.
And maybe more, hopefully more than that, but at least you'll get one. And you can you sense it as it's happening? Can you see, like, that person's locked in, that person's crying, something's happening with that person right there?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can feel it, and I can feel the crowd, and my radar goes really high for some reason when I'm public speaking. You know, like, if I'm out in front of an audience, I see everything, and I'm very aware of what's going on, and you know, it's, you know, that's why I'll grab a group and tell them to be quiet or get out, you know. I don't,
right.
You know, there's no, I'm not putting up with that. I'm not going to spill my guts to you and let you goof off in the crowd.
Yeah.
You know, well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, it kind of naturally ties into coaching, right? And, you know, I watched the film yesterday thinking, man, it really seems like this guy could be a coach. Like, he's got that charisma. He knows basketball. He's good with people. Like, why wouldn't that eventually be what he does? So why wouldn't that be what you eventually do?
I don't know. And I would not close the door on that. You know, I said that to Scott. We were talking to Doug Gottlieb yesterday, and I said, you know, the reality of this is two and a half years ago, I was a repo man.
Yeah.
You know, I was repossessing people's cars in a tow truck for $25 a car and with three children.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, my life has changed drastically. And you know, so I never know what will come.
Right.
Just our conversation right now, your tweet last night, Jonathan Hawk's film, the book, you know, changes lives. You know, not only people who are watching, but mine. I mean, I called Connor today, Connor Shell, and thanked him. You know, I mean, not only is having an impact on so many of you guys doing this, it's impacting me. You know, your influence in my life, and that's an amazing gift. So, you know, I don't know what it will bring. You know, I thought about getting into some type of commentating, TV stuff for games, but I don't know. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah. Well, I would love to see you coach, and obviously it's tough to plan too far ahead when,
sure,
when you're taking life 24 hours at a time, and that's got to, mm-hmm, be your mindset. I got to be honest, as I was watching last night, you know, I was worried for you because I'm thinking, like, this is kind of a victory lap. You know, this documentary, this night, this is a great night. It's like you're crossing the finish line now. You've arrived as this guy who, mm-hmm, who beat these long odds, who's turned his life around, who saved his family, who's doing something meaningful. And yet on Tuesday, you know, you can screw up and,
sure,
that's it. How do you get in that mindset of just not taking the victory lap and just saying, today's Wednesday, I'm going to wake up, I'm going through my routine, and,
sure,
I'm going to go to bed?
You know what? Honestly, my victory lap was a week and a half ago with my son. That was my victory lap. You know, watching it with him was my biggest victory in this. I do what I'm supposed to do daily. I check in 12 steps program. That's my thing. I love it. It keeps me honest. It's like my moral compass. It's something that I believe in that I will not replace. You know, if I have a meeting that I'm going to that day, nothing will interfere with that. Without my recovery, there is no dad. You know, there is no income. There is no future for me or my children. I don't want to bring them back to that dark place that they lived in, you know?
Right.
So,
and also, like, people, I think, sometimes mistakenly feel like addiction is a form of weakness. And,
sure,
it's not.
And that's,
it's
you know,
it's a chemical imbalance.
Sure. Yeah. It's a disease. I mean, and,
yeah,
it has to be treated, and it's not a deadly one, and it can be treated. And that's what I do on a daily basis. I treat it. And that empty void I had in my life for so many years, I filled it with dope and coke. And today I fill voids with, you know, spirituality and 12 steps and meetings and good people. And, you know, God willing, I'll stay on this path. But I don't live in fear of that. My life is too good today. Like, people say, like, oh, man. Like, they almost say it, like, poor you, that you have to live with this. Like,
right.
I'm living
you
a
threw
great...
it away.
Yeah, like, what did I throw away? you know, number one, I'm living a beautiful life. I'm a dad. I have an amazing sense of self-respect for myself today. And I can look at myself in the mirror, literally, you know. And
right.
To me, that's big. And that's enough. And so when people say, like, oh, you poor thing, you got to do it, you know, every day. It must be a struggle. No. A struggle when it was every day I was sticking needles in my arms. That's a struggle. Yeah. Walking around sober is not a struggle.
Well, and I also think last night's documentary, I haven't seen the ratings yet. It's not like, you know, it didn't do a Super Bowl rating or anything, but it probably, I don't know, maybe hopefully 1.5 million people watched it, something like that, and we'll have some re-airs and things like that, and it's going to affect people's lives. Like, I was getting emails yesterday, and people who had family members who battled this, or friends, or even the people themselves. Like, I think, you know, there's not enough on television. Either it goes a little too far, like, you know, like the celebrity rehab, things like that, where they're almost like parodies of the whole process, or just the hardcore addiction shows. And this was kind of, I think the reason that I feel like this documentary was so special was it was just a story. It was a story about you and what happened in your life and how addiction ruined it and how you kind of patched it back together.
Sure.
And I think anybody can identify with that. So I was really proud to just not even be involved, but just watch it happen.
Yeah, but you were, and that's the amazing thing. And like, I hope you and your crew get that feeling, you know, like, wow, you know, we're impacting lives, and number one, you impacted mine, and I can't thank you enough. I really can't.
I appreciate that. And, you know, 100% of the credit goes to Jonathan Haack, who has reached the point with ESPN Films where he just pitches us an idea and we say yes.
Yeah.
At this point, I think he could be like, hey, I want to do this documentary on a tree in my backyard. And be like, all right, here's money.
Perfect. Yeah.
Go do it. So, yeah, he was great. Last question.
Sure.
Do you still play hoops?
Occasionally. Occasionally in the gym with the guys, the college kids who come and work out with me, you know, there'll be an odd number. And I'll join in. I'll have to let them understand the enormity of the gorilla inside of me, you know.
Because, what do you mean? Explain that.
Yeah, I don't like playing because it doesn't matter where I'm playing or what I'm playing or who I'm playing. My heart rate will go from, you know, whatever it is, to triple. You know,
really?
It's like that competitor just wakes up and I don't like waking him up. You know, I really don't. And that's why I kind of, I'm not that far removed from it emotionally that I feel like, oh, I'll join an over 30 league or, you know, I'll get into this. I'm not. You know,
that's interesting. So like the way you played, especially at your peak, you had kind of this larger than life aura about you and, you know, the crowd booed you. You loved it. You used to make threes and do little gestures and you just had a real attitude, and I'm sure that attitude kind of translated to now I'm going out and I'm still larger than life. Now give me that line, I'll do it. I'm larger than life, Chris Herron.
Sure.
So you're afraid just by playing basketball that beast would be awoken potentially.
Just in the basketball sense.
Yeah.
You know, like when I always from a young age, the person across from me, I don't care who he was, that was gonna guard me or I was gonna guard, we were enemies. You know, I didn't care who you were. If I grew up with you, you were coming to take my stuff, and I approach it that way. And and that's how I've been taught since I was 6 years old to approach it that way. And so when I step on the court and I'm playing against college kids, and this kid wants to bump me a little bit, I'm like, oh, wait a second, you know, and
right.
You know, that guy comes back, you know, I'm not a particular fan of him, you know, I'm not, and you know, I like who I am. I don't want to be that guy anymore. So maybe someday, you know, maybe someday I'll have that, you know, that piece to go up and down and, you know, pass the ball around. But I can still dunk. I can still jump. I can still, you know, get up and down. So when guys come at me, I feel like I got to make a statement.
You still have the 25-footer?
No, of course. I can't lose that.
That is true. That is like one of those falling out of bed jump shots you had.
Yeah.
No, it really is. Like, you just see it. Yeah, age 50, I think you'll still have that. Some guys just have it.
I bring all the kids. I tell them I'm gonna drown you. And I tell them I'm gonna take you out. I'm gonna take you out where you can't swim, and you can't hold on to the sides. And we play horse, and you got these great shooters, college basketball players. And once
and
I take
win.
Them out to 25 feet, they don't know what to do with themselves.
Yeah, I always hear there's always like these random Larry Bird stories. It's like even now the guy's spine is fused together. He's over 50. He's just just probably a physical mess. And anytime somebody drags him on the court, he's making 25-footers. Like, it just
doesn't
go away.
Oh, yeah, and I bet you his heart rate goes up.
Yeah, he's probably feeling it. He's probably still mad he had to retire.
Yeah.
Chris Herron, congrats on the doc. Congrats on 3 years, 3 months being sober. Congrats on everything you're doing. And I'd love to have you back at some point to check in with you. But keep taking it 24 hours at a time. We're rooting for you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right.
All right, brother. I'll talk to you.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.